you would, get your Bibles out and open them to the book of 1 Corinthians. We'll be studying tonight in chapter 7. While you're doing that, I'll remind you that the book that we call 1 Corinthians is actually a letter that Paul wrote to the church at Corinth while he was in Ephesus on his third preaching tour. And he wrote it in anticipation of being there before too terribly long. There were two things that led Paul to write the letter. Number one, he heard some reports from Corinth about some things that were going on there, and some of those reports weren't the very best. So Paul wanted to address some of the problems that he had heard about. But the second thing that prompted the letter is that the Corinthians had written a letter to Paul, asking him some questions. He begins in chapter 7, "Now concerning the things about which you wrote," begins to address that subject. In fact, you'll see that expression several times in the book, "now concerning." Chapter 8, "now concerning things sacrificed to idols." Chapter 12, "now concerning spiritual gifts." "Now concerning the collection for the saints." Chapter 16. And it seems as though every time that little expression occurs, the apostle is taking up another subject that they had written him about and answering their questions and giving them some instruction about that. The first question that Paul deals with may well have been the first question they asked. That's questions to do with marriage, and that's what we want to talk about tonight in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. Now, as we address this passage, there are three things that we need to keep in mind. Number one, we don't know precisely what questions the Corinthians asked. Setting this chapter is a little bit like playing Jeopardy. You know, in that game, they give you the answer, and the contestant has to come up with a question, and we're a little bit like that. We have the answers, and we have to try to discern from that what the questions were. Number two, we don't know exactly what kind of views the Corinthians may have had about marriage and celibacy and some of the things that Paul talks about in the chapter. He was doubtless more familiar with some of the views, perhaps erroneous views, that they had about some things. And so he could address that, and we're just going to have to guess a little bit about what they may have been thinking about some of those things as well. Number three, as we'll point out as we go through the lesson, some of what Paul wrote was simply advice from the apostle based on current circumstances. Most of what's in the chapter is certainly principles that are applicable for all time. But there are some things that he said that pertain particularly to their circumstances in that special time, and we'll see that as we go. So, with that in mind, let's just ask and answer four questions. And I'm not pretending that these are necessarily the Corinthians' questions, but ask and answer four questions about marriage. Number one, what is marriage anyway? I think the apostle answers that right at the beginning. He says, "Now concerning the things about which you wrote, it is good for a man not to touch a woman, but because of immoralities, each man is to have his own wife, and each woman is to have her own husband." In verse 2, the apostle says, with reference to marriage, that each man is to have his own wife and each woman is to have her own husband. And he may well be thinking there about the very beginning in Genesis chapter 2 when God gave us this relationship and said, "For this cause a man shall leave his father and mother and shall cleave to his wife and the two shall become one flesh." Genesis 2 and verse 24. So what marriage is, it's the joining, the union of one man and one woman. Now, understanding that eliminates some alternatives. Sometimes people want to tamper with God's plan about this and come up with what they call alternative lifestyles or alternative relationships. But we may call them that, but so far as the Bible is concerned, this is what marriage is. Marriage is the union of one man and one woman. Each woman with her own husband, each husband with his own wife. Two or three things come to mind under the category of alternative arrangements here. Number one is when there is a coming together of two people, but there's no union there. They are not united together. They are not made one in marriage. I'm talking about two people who just choose to cohabit, to live together, as we say these days, and don't bother with marriage. And I remember when people really first started doing that and kind of making it public, they made a big thing about this. Well, the only difference between what we're doing and what you're doing is a piece of paper. That's the only difference. No, there's a world of difference in those two things. What is lacking in these modern relationships is the commitment that belongs to marriage. What is lacking in these modern relationships is the divine approval that belongs to marriage. What is lacking is God joining a man and a woman together as a unit. That's unique to marriage. It's missing in these other relationships. In fact, what the Bible calls a man and a woman who just live together and act as though they're husband and wife, even though they really aren't, the Bible calls that fornication. It's the word Paul uses in verse 2 here that in the New American Standard translation, which I use, he says, because of immoralities, because of fornication. The Bible says that is sinful. Another alternative is homosexual marriage. Two men marrying. The union of one man and another man, or the union of one woman and another woman. That, of course, has just become legal in our society within the last few years. First, it was in several states, and then a recent Supreme Court decision essentially made it legal throughout the country. Well, that may be illegal so far as man is concerned, but that's not acceptable as far as God is concerned. In fact, in the preceding chapter, in 1 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 9, the apostle asked, do you not know that the unrighteous will not inherit the kingdom of God? Do not be deceived. Neither fornicators, that's that man and woman that are just living together, nor idolaters, nor adulterers, nor effeminate, nor homosexuals, nor thieves, nor the covetous, nor drunkards, nor revilers, nor swindlers, will inherit the kingdom of God. The Bible makes it plain that that conduct is not acceptable in any way, shape, or form. And then that Supreme Court decision has now opened up another debate, which wasn't hard to see coming, about another alternative arrangement, and that is polygamy, where you have one man and multiple wives. Or maybe somebody will turn that around one of these days and have one woman with multiple husbands. But be that as it may, that's not God's plan. That's not marriage as God gave it. That's not marriage as God defines it. So that's the first thing the apostle wants us to get clear in our minds, what marriage is. Marriage is the union of one man and one woman. Question number 2. Well, should I get involved in that? Should I marry? The opening verse of the chapter surprises us, I think, as we begin to read. He said, now concerning the things about which you wrote, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. And in the context of this chapter, when he talks about not touching the woman, that is touching her in the physical sense of the joining of a husband and wife. In other words, the first thing that Paul says about this is, it's good not to do that. He seems to be, to me, agreeing with something that the Corinthians had written on this subject. There were probably some of them who were advocating that somehow they might be better if they would abstain from marriage. And they're asking Paul, what do you think about that? And Paul actually agrees with them on that. He says, that's a good thing to abstain from that. It's a good thing not to do that. Well, why would Paul say that? Couple of reasons that are given in the chapter. One reason is, in view of the present distress, look with me down at verse 26. He says, I think then that it is good in view of the present distress that it is good for a man to remain as he is. Are you bound to a wife? Do not seek to be released. Are you released from a wife? Do not seek a wife. He said earlier in the chapter that he thought this was a good thing for people to remain unmarried as he was. And part of his reason here is because of the present distress. Now again, this gets to the advice that he's given in view of their local situation. The present distress was evidently some wave of persecution that some of them were facing. Back in the third and fourth chapters of this letter, Paul had talked about the persecution that he faced as an apostle. In chapter 15, he comes back to that again. In fact, he says in chapter 15, I die daily. And he described himself as fighting with wild beasts at Ephesus. And so what he's saying to these Christians is, in the time of intense persecution, which was that kind of a time for Paul, in light of that, it might well be better not to marry. And I think we can understand that. Because our commitment to Christ has to rise above everything else. Even above the commitment that we make to a husband and wife, or the commitment and the obligations we have to our children. And it would be one thing for me to be able to stand before some civil authorities and say, I don't care what you do to me, I'm not going to renounce my faith in Christ. You can take my life if you want, but I'm going to be loyal to Christ. That's one thing. For me to have to stand there and make that same kind of commitment, knowing that they may well butcher my wife in my presence if I don't renounce my faith, or my children. We can all understand how that would even be harder, wouldn't it? And that's the kind of thing the apostle is talking about. And he's simply saying, given that circumstance, the present distress, I think it's good for a man to remain as he is. Another thing that enters into the picture in verse 32 is he wants them to be free from distress. He says, I want you to be free from concern. One who is unmarried is concerned about the things of the Lord, how he may please the Lord. But one who is married is concerned about the things of the world, how he may please his wife, and his interests are divided. The woman who is unmarried and the virgin is concerned about the things of the Lord, that she may be both holy both in body and spirit. But one who is married is concerned about the things of the world, how she may please her husband. This I say for your own benefit, not to put a restraint upon you, but to promote what is appropriate and to secure undistracted devotion to the Lord. This again is simply Paul's advice. He says, I'm not binding this on you. I'm not putting a restraint on you here, but this is his way of looking at it. That a person who is married has some additional obligations, some additional responsibilities, some additional concerns that the single man or the single woman doesn't have. Consider Paul himself. He's a single man. And because of that, Paul is able to travel. He is free to come and go. He is free from obligations regarding his family. He's free from concern about his family. And think of all the times, all the years that he spent on the road. And he never knew what his circumstance would be. He never knew what his schedule would be. He never knew when he left home how long he might be gone, or for that matter, whether he would even ever come home or not. Now, it's one thing for a single man to do that. He can do that without concern about how that might affect a wife or children. If you're married, you can't do that nearly so freely. You've either got to make arrangements to be able to come home with your family with regularity in order to be the father and husband that you need to be, or else you've got to make arrangements for them to go with you. Now just imagine Paul trying to bring along a wife and two or three or four children on his preaching trips with all the things that he went. Can you imagine the burden that that would have been? And that again is his point. That there are maybe circumstances in which in our service to the Lord we'll actually be freer to be devoted to what we're trying to do in the Lord's service if we're not married and don't have children than we would be if we did. And there might be another reason or two where the apostle would suggest that it might be better not to marry, but he's certainly, again, just giving his advice in some circumstances. But we don't want to take this too far. We don't want to suggest that somehow Paul was against marriage altogether. When he says it's good not to marry, that certainly doesn't imply that it's bad too. In fact, Paul is going to commend marriage in a number of circumstances. And he points out even in this text that there's no matter of sin involved if somebody does that. He says in this text that that a person is not going to sin if he marries. Verse 28, if you marry, you've not sinned. If a virgin marries, she's not sinned. Yet such will have trouble in this life, and I'm trying to spare you. There again, it's in that present distress paragraph. The truth of the matter is, there may be some real good reasons why a person would choose to marry. Think back about why God gave marriage at the very beginning. God gave marriage because He looked at Adam in the garden and He said in Genesis 2 and verse 18, it is not good for the man to be alone. I will therefore make a helper suitable to him. I will make for him a companion that is appropriate to or suitable to or corresponding to him. In other words, God looked at that man and said, that man is missing something there, being alone. And so when man received as a gift from God his wife, that brought a completeness to his life that wasn't there before that. And so for all of those reasons and everything associated with that, it is a good thing to marry. In verse 2 of this text, the apostle gives another reason. He says, because of immorality, because of fornication, let each man have his own wife, and let each woman have her own husband. One of the things that God gives in the marriage relationship is the privilege of sexual union between the husband and the wife. That's the only circumstance in which God gives that privilege. But for a man to be able to fulfill that and for a woman to be able to fulfill that, this is the relationship God has given for that, and therefore it becomes a preventive to wrong ways of fulfilling that, those things that the Bible calls fornication. So there are lots of good reasons why a person would marry. Paul was certainly not against it. In a passage like 1 Timothy chapter 5, for example, he's going to recommend that younger widows go out and marry and bear children and keep the house and do those things. That will help them in their service to God in their circumstances. He's just saying to the Corinthians, in some circumstances, marriage may not be the very best thing. Normally it's going to be for folks, but in some circumstances it may not. In other words, it's not the worst thing in the world if you're not married. That's okay. There are worse things than being unmarried, and one of them is being married to the wrong person. And the apostle will have some things to say about that in the course of his letters. But let's go on to something else. What are the obligations of marriage? Question 3. What is bound upon us if we're going to marry? You notice in verse 3, the apostle uses the word duty. The husband must fulfill his duty to his wife, and likewise also the wife to her husband. This word that's translated duty in 1 Corinthians 7 and verse 3 is a word that is translated debt in most places in the New Testament. It refers to something that is an obligation, something that is owed. And so as a husband or as a wife, as a party to a marriage relationship, I have some obligations. There are some things that I owe Sandy. And there are some things that she owes me in this relationship. What is it that we owe each other? What are the obligations of marriage? Well, I'm going to present to you 4 tonight. These are just kind of broad categories. There are a lot of specifics within these. The first one is what I'll call the personal. I'm just going to put these into 4 general categories. But the first one would be the personal obligations. And that takes us back to Genesis 2 as to why God gave us this relationship to start with. It's because we're alone without it. And the mate is the companion. It's the partner. It's the fulfillment. And so all those things that come with being a companion or a mate, that's the personal obligations that I have. Things like encouragement, support, help, communication, a sense of need, a sense of satisfaction, sharing together in life. That's all what companionship is. And that's the obligation that we have in marriage. I had an interesting circumstance years ago when I was preaching another place. There was a person I was acquainted with who got married, and we were living in Central Florida at the time, and his wife lived up in the Panhandle. And after they got married, he kept living in Central Florida, and she kept living up in the Panhandle. And he'd go see her once every month or two, and she'd come see him once every month or two, and beyond that, they just kept right on going the same way they'd always been going. And I thought, he must have a sure different sense of marriage than I do. That's not my idea of companionship. I don't think it's yours either, is it? You see, that's the obligation we have, to share life together. Beyond that, there is also the material sharing that goes on. We often cite 1 Timothy 5 and verse 8, where the apostle said, if any man does not provide for his own, he's worse than an unbeliever. I would point out that contextually in 1 Timothy 5 and 8, providing for your own family is not really quite so much a husband providing for his wife and children as it is the children providing for parents or grandparents as they progress in age and need our care. But the principle is there. It is the principle of a family providing for itself. And the provision in that place is food and clothing and shelter and those basic things of life. And that's a part of what we do in marriage. We share those things. And the husband has to work to provide those things. Proverbs 31, the worthy woman, she is working to help provide in these areas too. And maybe we work in a little different realms of that, but we're all working to provide, to share for the family unit. That's one of the obligations we have. In this text, Paul mentions a third one, and that is the physical obligations we have toward one another. He says in verse 4, the wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. Likewise also, the husband does not have wife over his own body, but the wife does. Stop depriving one another, except by agreement for a time, so that you may devote yourselves to prayer, and come together again so that Satan will not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. But this I say by way of concession, not of command. Paul is talking about the physical joining of the man and the woman here. Again, this is the relationship in which God gives us this privilege, and it's one of the parts of marriage. It's one of the obligations that we have to one another. Evidently, some of the Corinthians were thinking that somehow celibacy was a greater way of life whether you were married or not married. And so Paul is trying to address that and correct that misconception that they had. I want to suggest a fourth one, and that is something in the spiritual realm. I don't know that I could necessarily prove that spiritual obligations are an inherent part of the relationship of marriage for everyone. But I do know this. I do know that the Bible speaks about Christians and their spiritual responsibilities to one another in marriage. Peter talks about that. 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 1. He said, in the same way, you wives, be submissive to your own husbands, so that even if any of them are disobedient to the word, they may be won without a word by the behavior of their wives as they observe your chaste and respectful behavior. Peter envisions a marriage in which the wife is a Christian and the husband is not. And she has an obligation in that relationship to live as a light, to live in such a way that she may be able to win him without a word. He won't listen to preaching, but maybe by her influence, by her godly example, she can win him to Christ. That's in the spiritual realm, isn't it? That's trying to help him spiritually. In verse 7, Peter turns that around. He says, likewise, you husbands, live with your wives in an understanding way, as with someone weaker, since she is a woman. And show her honor as a fellow heir of the grace of life so that your prayers will not be hindered. The husband is to honor his wife as a fellow heir of the grace of God. Now, that place, Peter's clearly expecting that the husband and the wife are both Christians. And the husband is to regard his wife as a fellow heir of these blessings from God and is to treat her and honor her in that way. And the idea of that is living in such a way as to promote her spirituality. So this is a part of the obligation that we have as marriage, those of us who are Christians, to live in this relationship in such a way as to help each other out spiritually, to help us grow and mature and be faithful to the Lord. In other words, to help one another go to heaven, to put it in plain terms. One more question before we close. What about ending marriage? What does the Apostle have to say to us in 1 Corinthians 7 about ending the marriage? Well, the first thing that he says about that is he reminds us plainly in verse 39 that this is a lifelong relationship. He says a wife is bound as long as her husband lives. That agrees exactly with what Jesus said when he said, "What God has joined together, let no man separate." This is a lifelong relationship. I tell you, when the marriage ends, it ends when one of them dies. That's when it ends, so far as God's plan is concerned. And somebody asked about that. Well, what if my spouse dies? What then? The apostle goes on to say, if her husband is dead, she is free to be married to whom she wishes, only in the Lord. But in my opinion, she's happier if she remains as she is. And I think that I also have the Spirit of God. And once again, you notice that he offers an opinion here in addition to the truth, the fact. The fact is, the principle is, that once the mate has died, the other one is free to marry whomever they will, only in the Lord. But his opinion is, you'd be better off not to. Again, in view of the present distress, in view of those concerns that we talked about a little bit earlier. One comment about that expression, in the Lord, in this place. Exactly what does he mean when he says, she's free to remarry whomever she wills, only in the Lord? There's some different ideas about that. I would just point out to you that when that expression, in the Lord, is used in other passages, in family matters, it means in keeping with what the Lord would have us do, or in view of our relationship to the Lord. For example, in Colossians 3, the husband is to live with his wife in the right way, and the wife is to be subject to her husband in the Lord, the text says. Be subject to your husband in the Lord. That doesn't just mean if he's a Christian or if she is, but be subject to your husband in view of your relationship to the Lord. Ephesians 6 and verse 1, children, obey your parents in the Lord, that is, in view of the Lord, in view of that being the Lord's will. And I think that's what it means in this place too, that whom she marries, that marriage has to be done in view of what the Lord's will is, what the Lord teaches on this subject. But clearly the apostle is saying that if your mate dies, you are free to remarry another, even though he thinks it might be better in their circumstances if they didn't. Somebody says, well, that's all fine and dandy, but what if we don't get along? What if we have a lot of trouble in our marriage? What if we don't think we're going to make it for a lifetime? What do we do then? Well, he addresses that a little bit earlier. He said in verse 10, to the married I give instructions, not I but the Lord. In other words, he's quoting what Jesus said here. That the wife should not leave her husband. And verse 11, that the husband should not divorce his wife. I'll point out to you that in verse 10, that word leave, the wife should not leave her husband. That's exactly the same word that Jesus used in Matthew 19 and verse 6 when he said, what God has joined together, let no man separate. Paul is not talking in 1 Corinthians 7 and verse 10 simply about a woman separating from her husband or leaving him for a time. He's talking about divorce, just as he is in verse 11. And what does he say? To the married I give instruction. The wife should not leave her husband. The husband should not divorce his wife. In other words, stay together. That's God's plan. What if somebody sets God's plan aside? What if they do that anyway, even though God said not to and without His permission? Well, he adds in verse 11, if she does leave, she must remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband. What the apostle does in verse 11 is just state what we have always implied from Matthew chapter 19 in verse 6, and that is that if a person decides to divorce apart from what God said, violating what God said, then that person hasn't got but two choices going forward. He's got to remain unmarried, because as Jesus taught, to marry someone else would be adultery, or else be reconciled to the husband. But what Paul says is, don't do that. Don't leave. Don't divorce. What if my spouse isn't a Christian? Does that affect the longevity of this relationship? Does that affect things somehow? Now the apostle addresses that in the next verse, verse 12. To the rest, I say not the Lord, and he doesn't mean by that he's just making this up and doesn't have the Lord's blessing with this. He's simply saying this is not a circumstance that Jesus addressed while he was on the earth, so he can't quote the Lord on that, but he's speaking as an inspired apostle. To the rest, I say not the Lord, that if any brother has a wife who is an unbeliever, she consents to live with him, he must not divorce her. And a woman who has an unbelieving husband, and he consents to live with her, she must not send her husband away. The apostle says the fact that one of you is a Christian and the other one is not doesn't somehow make that relationship an inherently wrong one. And I can understand why some at Corinth may have had questions about that. Maybe some of them were looking at this from the standpoint of what the Old Testament had to say. You know, in the Old Testament, there were specific prohibitions against the Israelites marrying women from certain nations. Some of them did that anyway. And in a passage like Ezra chapter 10 or Nehemiah 13, when people were doing that, Ezra particularly in chapter 10 was quite adamant that those people had to end those relationships because they were wrong. And so maybe some of them at Corinth were thinking, well, if I'm in one of those relationships where the husband or the wife is not a Christian, Have I done the same thing that the Old Testament people did, and do I need to do the same thing? Do I need to abandon that? And the apostle says, no. No, if the person who's not a Christian is willing to live with you, you just go right on together in that relationship. Don't end that. Don't divorce over that. It's not something that's inherently wrong. On the other hand, he says in verse 15, if the unbelieving one leaves, let him leave. The brother or sister is not under bondage in such cases, but God has called us to peace. If that person to whom you are married is not willing to live with you because of your religious differences, if because you've become a Christian, he doesn't want anything to do with you anymore, or she doesn't, and you've got two choices now. You can either stay with the Lord or you can stay with that mate. If the unbeliever leaves, let him leave, says the apostle. We're not under bondage. The word there means slavery. We're not slaves to a husband and a wife where we serve them at the cost of serving the Lord. Because he asked in verse 16, how do you know, O wife, whether you will save your husband? Or how do you know, O husband, whether you will save your wife? We're trying to do that. We're trying to save that spouse. But we don't know whether we're going to be able to do that or not. Since there's that possibility, he says, if you have some religious differences, stay together and try to influence them for good and try to teach them. But if they are insistent on leaving, you're not a slave to that person. There's no guarantee you're ever going to be able to bring them around. And so don't abandon the Lord in order to follow them. That's just backwards. Now, I would point out to you that there's nothing that he says in that paragraph about a Christian being married to someone who is not that would in any way recommend that's what you do. Okay, I don't know of any passage in the Bible that recommends that somebody who serves the Lord in their lives marry somebody who doesn't. Can't think of a single passage that even comes close to recommending that. But if you are in that circumstance, the apostle says, don't think that somehow you should end your marriage just based on that. And there are some other things that he says in the chapter. We obviously didn't cover the entire chapter tonight, but those are some very basic questions about marriage that the apostle addresses, and maybe that'll be helpful to us. And that's our lesson. So let's get ready now to sing our song of invitation. It's obvious from what we've said tonight that the marriage the apostle has in view in this text is an optional thing. There's another kind of marriage that we are to be involved in that's not optional for our salvation. And that is our marriage to Christ. The Bible sometimes depicts God's people, and often depicts God's people as His bride. Even in the New Testament, the church is depicted as the bride of Christ. We have to be joined to Christ. We have to become one with Him if we're going to be saved. We do that by making Him the Lord in our lives, confessing our faith in Him, being baptized into Him, putting Him on, clothing ourselves with Him. Is there someone tonight who needs to take that step? We'd like to encourage you to do that. We'd like to help you with that in any way that we can. If you're ready, come to the front while we stand together and sing.